In our hometown of Portland, Oregon, something interesting just happened. They just passed, with 87% of the vote, a limit on campaign contributions. Oregon's never had, is only one of the only states with no limits on campaign contributions. One dude gave $4.5 million to a single candidate in the last campaign. The county passed a similar thing, 89% of the vote. Governor of Oregon just said now is the time for Oregon to change. In Portland, there was just passed a 6-to-1 matching system that if you gave $50, another $300 would go into it. Again, meaning that if 1,000 people were going to fund a campaign and give $50 to that campaign, that's $50,000. Maybe you can pay for something. But now it means $350,000, which is about the budgetary level that several city council candidates have had and won. How are we going to get democracy to function? And if the way that campaigns work, the way that elections work, is paying for stuff, how should that work? How should campaigns pay for stuff? How should they collect money to pay for stuff? This is the Democracy Nerd series on campaign finance. We're going to be interviewing fellow democracy nerds to get to the bottom of what's happening, go to somewhat, to some degree, deep dives on this stuff, what has already happened, what might happen. Thanks for being with us. My name's Jeff, by the way. I'm, like you, a democracy nerd. November of 2018, Portland voters passed Local Initiative 26200, a city charter amendment placing limits on political campaign contributions. It passed by a big margin, got 87% of the vote. That measure was nearly identical to a similar measure placing limits on county elections, which was approved by voters in 2016 with 89% of the vote. The coalition behind these measures felt they were necessary to address the fact that Oregon has some of the most expensive elections per capita in the country.
Dan Meek, Honest Portland Elections.
Oregon is one of only five states with no limits on political campaign contributions. The others spell out, just think of the national basketball champions, Villanova. Nevada, Oregon, Virginia, Alabama, that's Nova, and then there's U, Nova U, U is Utah. The result is that Oregon has among the most expensive campaigns in America. Our race for governor just was an example of that, where over $40 million was spent. Typical winner of a contested seat in the Oregon House now is spending upwards of $800,000 to $1 million just to get the 12,000 votes or so to get to the Oregon House. So the reason Oregon doesn't have any limits, I mean, it's not the fault of the voters. The voters have passed them four times since 1906. But the Oregon Supreme Court in 1997 decided that somehow the Oregon Constitution doesn't allow limits on political campaign contributions, our free speech clause. But our free speech clause is exactly the same as 36 other states. We didn't invent it in 1859. We borrowed it from the other states. And no other state court or federal court in America has held that any state free speech clause prevents limits on political campaign contributions.
Jason Kafori, Honest Portland Elections.
Let's start with one huge factor that happened a couple months ago. $4.5 million given by one of our billionaires, Phil Knight, to the Republican gubernatorial candidate. That's shocking. That's not an even playing field. That's not a place where all citizens can participate in politics, is it, right? Yeah. So I think that sent shockwaves across the establishment.
With the passage of these two measures, candidates in Portland and Multnomah County elections cannot receive corporate contributions, individual donations are limited to $500, and key funders, top funders, on campaign materials must be disclosed. And judging from the landslide margin by which both measures passed, these restrictions are quite popular with local voters.
There have been other states where billionaires come and buy off state legislatures, they come and buy off Supreme Courts, and the Supreme Courts then come in and start putting laws in place. That's happened across the country. We are at a moment right now which either we do the right thing in Oregon over the next year and a half, or else we're facing a time where the billionaire class can come to Oregon and play ball and start electing the people that they want to play ball with.
In the wake of the 2012 Supreme Court Citizens United ruling, which effectively removed caps on corporate campaign contributions, local campaign finance reform efforts are seen as a means to provide balance to the deep-pocketed funding crew.
Kristen Eberhard, senior researcher, Sightline Institute.
The question is, are some of these reforms that have been bubbling up at the local level in Seattle and in Portland, are those going to take hold and spread so that we, the people, can take back our democracy? We've got the tools. We're actually putting them into place in here in the Pacific Northwest. But will we be able to build that movement even bigger to statewide and nationwide elections?
In the Northwest, Seattle implemented its own version of campaign finance reform prior to Portland with implementations of voter-approved democracy dollars in 2015.
Liz Dupree, director, Washington Democracy Hub.
Tell us about the democracy voucher program in Seattle that you're working on.
Oh, sure thing. Well, the Democracy Voucher Program was passed in 2015 and through the efforts of a 10-organization coalition. And it basically gives $100 in vouchers, so four $25 vouchers, to each Seattle resident to be able to give to the candidate of their choice for designated offices. For example, in 2017, there were a few Seattle district, city council district races that the vouchers were eligible for. In 2019, however, all seven are going to be up for vouchers. So there'll be a lot more people at the table. But yeah, that's the gist of the program. You get these vouchers and you can give them to whatever candidate you'd like.
Seattle's democracy dollars provide $100 in vouchers for residents to give to the candidates of their choice.
A lot harder to be able to put a cap in place. There are constitutional issues and legal issues, and of course there's the whole federal there's the federal decision, the Citizens United decision, and related cases that say that money is speech. So putting caps on contributions can oftentimes be considered unconstitutional. So instead, we said, great, if that's the situation and that's not changing for a long time, let's try a different route. Let's find a way to have people who don't have the same means as their wealthy counterparts to be able to participate and choose who candidates for office.
So I understand the policy value of the voucher system over a matching system. That I talked to Commissioner Fritz, and I'm in favor of her system. We had proposed actually a voucher system. They had preferred the matching system, and you pretty articulate, you know, pretty clearly stated the advantages. Well, the example that I used was the constituent that I talked to, who was an embarrassingly aha moment for me when I was talking to her, and she said, well, I have three kids. They each play three sports, but now sports cost about $100 a piece. And so I had to tell them they each can only play two sports. That means one term, whether it's fall or spring or summer, they don't get to play their sport. They have to figure out what their third favorite sport is, and they don't get to play that one. So when I'm talking to Commissioner Fritz, and I'm like, oh, heck yes, you get $50 and you get it match 6X. What if you don't have the $50? I've talked to people for who $100, they don't got the $100. It doesn't feel like a great favor that money they don't have gets matched. Zero times six is still zero. So I see the advantage of the voucher system. It seems like the counter, the challenge, is about administration. How do you get the vouchers distributed? How do you collect them? How are they transferred? How are they bundled or not bundled? How do you make sure there's not graft? How do you make sure they aren't lost? How do you keep track of them? Talk to us about the administration. That's presumably one of the things you're working on right now.
Yes, most definitely. And, you know, that's actually been a huge part of this program. You know, policy aside, it's great and I love it. I come from working in anti-poverty, so the whole policy behind it is something that is just right up my alley, even personally and my own personal values. But when it comes to actually making the program work, that has been the source of so much cooperation and conversation and discussion. In the initiative itself, we designated the Seattle Ethics and Elections Commission as the enacting agency, the agency that would oversee the program, oversee all the collection of the vouchers and, you know, I guess, distribution to different candidates. And in that time, we started creating a relationship with them. We spoke and still continue to speak fairly regularly with SEC, the Elections Commission, and we're also part of their advisory committee as well. Not only the Democracy Hub Win-Win Network groups, but also other groups who do have a stake in just the overall health of the city, like Seattle Libraries and groups like that, are there to be able to just kind of make sure that things are going well, hear different updates, and be sort of a sounding voice. So in terms of, or sounding board, should I say. So in terms of administration that way, we've been very, very close with the commission to make sure that not only are our ideals and values reflected in the implementation of the program, but also that we're doing everything legally. So, you know, there's an issue with bundling, like you said. You mentioned the word, the key term. Bundling is actually illegal on the state level here in Washington State. So we as organizations cannot go out to the public and door knock and say, hey, give me your vouchers and I'll give them to candidate, you know, XYZ for you. We're not allowed to do that. And so we worked with SEEK to make sure that that was a non-possibility, to make sure that we were following the law correctly there. That's just one example about, you know, the little hiccups in interpretation that we could see. But overall, around cost, the program itself had a cost mechanism written into the initiative as well. So it was one of the smallest property taxes, but a property tax nonetheless, one of the smallest property taxes we've ever exacted on Seattle residents, or asked Seattle residents to approve, should I say. They approved that, and they raised about $3 million, I would say, per cycle, which has to be raised on the front end to be able to distribute to candidates. And so once that tax levy comes in, the money goes to, you know, SEEK's different financial units who then hold on to those funds. When the vouchers come from residents to candidates or to SEEK itself, you can send it right to the agency and say, I want you to send my money to XYZ candidate. When those vouchers do come in, it is then SEEK's job to validate the vouchers, make sure the signatures are right, and then send out the funds to each candidate, I believe twice a month.
The hope for democracy dollars is that by providing public funds for Seattle citizens to donate to their preferred candidate, involvement in the political process by groups outside the donor class would increase. Effectively, all residents of Seattle were now also likely campaign donors. Portland did have a previous experiment providing public funding for qualified candidates with the city's voter-owned election system on the books from 2005-2010. The voter-owned election system resulted in a high-profile fraud case, also, though, led to the election, non-fraudulent to be clear, of Commissioner Amanda Fritz, who's the only city commissioner in Portland history to be elected via a publicly funded campaign.
Amanda Fritz, Commissioner, City of Portland.
I don't know that people realize or recognize the benefits, all the benefits and the times that I've saved them money because of having run with public financing. There's been so many times that I didn't have to listen to anybody other than the people of Portland who were just writing in or talking to me about things, and I didn't have to think about who do I owe from getting election, because I owed every taxpayer in Portland.
The cases of fraud led Portland voters to repeal voter-owned elections in 2010. However, Commissioner Fritz was one of the deciding votes for Portland open and accountable elections approved by the City Council in December of 2016, a new system. Portland Open and Accountable Elections provides a 6-to-1 match of public funding, $50, leveraging public funds for qualified candidates running against opponents that might have more access to big donors and other means of campaign funding.
It's the Open and Accountable Election System, and we just appointed the commission just this past Wednesday. So the citizen oversight body that's going to look into all the administrative rules and the administration of the system. We appointed them on Wednesday, so we're hoping it'll be ready to go as of July 1st of this year, so it'll be ready to be used by candidates for mayor and city council in the 2020 election. Now, it's not the same at all as voter-owned elections. Under voter-owned elections, I had to collect 1,000 donations of $5 from regular Portland voters, and then I got a lump sum. as did the other candidates who qualified. In this system, there's a lot of rules about how you get to be a qualified candidate and what you have to do and not do in order to do that. But then once you are, the first $50 of a contribution from a Portland resident gets matched 6-1 by the city. So a $50 contribution gets matched with $300 of city money and becomes $350. So $50 is nice when people give it to you during a campaign. And of course, most people can get a tax credit or a loan from the state. So you get the money right back again when you file your tax return. But not a lot of people can give $350. And so it's a way to make sure that campaigns get a reasonable amount of money and that they have to keep working at it, because it's a matching system. It's not like you get to the threshold and you're done. You're going to have to keep going to talking to Portlanders all over the city and raising these small donations. You can't raise more than $250 from anybody except during the seed money, the kind of pre-qualifying stage. And so it's going to keep money out of politics in a way which is absolutely 100% constitutional.
The shared goal of local campaign finance reform measures in Portland Open and Accountable Elections is to increase involvement in the political process by marginalized communities. Oregon has the second most expensive elections per capita in the nation, just behind New Jersey. If a candidate is not independently wealthy or doesn't have easy access to a bunch of dough, they start at a significant disadvantage, regardless of ideas or proposals.
Juan Carlos, Honest Portland Elections.
In congressional races, 9 out of 10 times, the candidate that raises the most money wins. And for a candidate of color, they don't have nearly the access to the donor class as a white candidate may have. And so they tend to raise less money, and they're less likely to win as a result.
Sharon Mirren, Commissioner, Multnomah County.
Say, when I first decided to run for Multnomah County Commission, you know, for some deeply held beliefs and values, and knowing what I felt I could contribute to the county, one of the key things that I knew from the get-go was that I was going to have to raise a lot of money. I was told, okay, you don't get to go out there and talk about the issues that are important to you. You don't get to talk to voters. You don't get to talk to people in the community. You need to get on the phone and start calling everyone you know and asking them for money. The more people you know who have more money, the better things will be for you.
Evidence that local campaign finance reform will lead to expanded political process by previously ignored communities is suggested by some of the results of Seattle's use of democracy dollars.
Kristen Eberhard, Senior Researcher, Sightline Institute.
It's a two-way street, right? So for people to feel like they are participating in democracy and they have a voice and they matter in who runs and how they run, that, you know, that's going one direction. But in the other direction, it's really important too that the people who are running, who are they paying attention to? Who are they spending all of their time with? Who are they talking to? Who are they trying to wine and dine? When you have dial for dollars and you only have to talk to, you know, a few thousand people, in the last mayoral election in Portland, Wheeler raised most of his money from just a few hundred people. Those people have big checkbooks. They can write big checks, and they have a certain interest in what city government does. So if you're spending all your time talking to them, you're going to get a certain flavor to what's important in the city, compared to if you're talking to 15,000 people, then you're going to city halls, you're going to neighborhoods all over the city. You're not just staying in the West Hills, you're going to the East Side, and you're talking to people about what they want from the city. So you as a candidate and later as a lawmaker are getting a whole different flavor of what's important to people.
In Seattle's 2013 election, most campaign donations came from older, whiter neighborhoods. In the city's 2017 elections, campaign donations were spread throughout the city's economically diverse neighborhoods, with a huge increase in donations from younger and lower-income voters.
In 2013, there were 4 city races and 5,800 people contributed. In 2017, there were 3 city races and 15,100 people contributed, so approximately a quadrupling.
Even homeless Seattle residents were engaged in political process, courted by some candidates.
Liz Dupree, Director, Washington Democracy Hub.
We're seeing a lot of new people running for office. In fact, one of the people who is currently in office at the city council did credit their decision to run based on democracy vouchers, Teresa Mosqueda. So, you know, we are seeing that, and she herself was a labor leader too. So, you know, we are seeing that, yeah, more people of color, more community-based candidates are seeing hope and a path to being elected to office because they actually do have this, you know, financial mechanism that doesn't have to come out of their own pocket. And not only that, but we're seeing more and more people being paid attention to. So there might have been some news, you might be privy to it, of former city council candidate John Grant, formerly of the Tenants Union of Washington. He started off his voucher campaign in houselessness camps. He went and said, hey, I've been representing you for years and I've been talking about these issues for years, but I can't do as much on the nonprofit side as I could do in office. So if you give me your voucher, I promise I'll work for you. And sure enough, I believe he was the first one to max out. And so, you know, yes, there's some blowback. Are you exploiting people? You know, those sort of questions were brought up. But at the end of the day, it is an amazing time and chance for community and oriented people and actual regular citizens to be able to choose where they want to put their money because they know that that community-centered candidate is going to be championing their issue.
After the large turnout in favor of campaign finance reform by Multnomah County voters, the measure immediately saw a legal challenge. The free speech clause in the Oregon Constitution has been interpreted to stymie efforts to place limits on previous campaign finance reform statutes. With the 1997 ruling that any effort to place limits on campaign funding is a free speech violation. Oregon's free speech clause is shared with that of 36 other states, all of which have some form of limitation on campaign contribution.
Dan Meek, Honest Portland Elections.
The case, the 1997 case, which I call Oregon's Citizens United on steroids, because it's far worse than the Citizens United decision, has been at least half repudiated by the court.
Say that case again. Say the year of the case that allows unfettered contributions in Oregon.
1997, and the name of it is Vannata.
Vannata case. Thank you.
Fred Vannata. Yep. Vannata versus Kiesling. Phil Kiesling was Secretary of State at the time and was defending the ballot measure that Oregon voters had enacted in 1994.
Jason Kafori, Honest Portland Elections.
The U.S. Supreme Court has never struck down limits on campaign contributions by individuals. That is for our entire U.S. history. There's no U.S. Supreme Court that said if a state had a limit of $500 or $1,000 or $2,000 per person that was unconstitutional. That's never happened at the U.S. Supreme Court level. In fact, the U.S. Supreme Court was offered a case with the Kavanaugh Court a few weeks ago where Montana had $500 limits, and the U.S. Supreme Court passed on hearing that case. They passed on hearing that case. Not only is the U.S. Supreme Court never ruled contribution limits to be unconstitutional, 37 other states, I have the list here, 37 other states have the exact same free speech clause. Each of them declares that every person has the right to speak, write, or print freely on any subject. That's the one sentence. That's the one sentence. A few of them use the word publish instead of the word print, but that's it. And you know how those 37 states have identified that clause as allowing limits on big money in politics?
2016's Honest Elections Multnomah County measure was challenged by the Portland Business Alliance, Associated Oregon Industries, and the Portland Metropolitan Association of Realtors. In March 2018, a Multnomah County circuit judge ruled the 2016 measure, backed by 89% of the vote, was, in fact, unconstitutional. And in January 2019, the Oregon Supreme Court announced that they will hear appeal on it. Depending on how the state Supreme Court rules, Oregon voters may be able to place limits on political campaign contributions without violating free speech and without amending the Constitution.
Sharon Mirren, Commissioner, Multnomah County.
Now that it's been accepted for review by the Supreme Court, I think we need to be doing everything we can to be ready to implement as soon as the Supreme Court says yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so just working on all of this right now, because I think it will make a tremendous difference in who runs for office, who is able to run for office, who sees it as possible in the breadth and the diversity of the candidates that we see out there, which is so important to be representative in our democracy. So.
The Northwest has become an epicenter of campaign finance reform efforts in the United States. We're not sure how these measures will turn out. Other measures to restrict campaign contributions at a statewide level and maybe even federal level are also under consideration, and we'll explore those potential developments in the next installment of Democracy Nerd, the Campaign Finance Reform Podcast.